The Guardian.
UK lockdown set to continue as the Prime Minister battles COVID-19 from intensive care. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return. We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
On Sunday night, as the Queen gave a rare televised address to the nation, reassuring Britons that the country will get through the coronavirus outbreak just as it got through the last war, Boris Johnson was hospitalised to help deal with his ongoing symptoms. The next day, the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, told us that the Prime Minister had been transferred to the intensive care unit.
And I'm confident he'll pull through. Because if there's one thing I know about this Prime Minister, he's a fighter.
As we record this, the Prime Minister is said to be stable and in good spirits. But the news came as stark proof that coronavirus does not discriminate. Even the most defended person in the country, apparently fit and strong, and with access to the very best doctors, is vulnerable. With a three-week lockdown review seeming unlikely, we'll be asking who's now really in charge of the government. Politicians from all sides were quick to send good wishes to the Prime Minister, including the newly elected leader of the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer. This week, he announced his new shadow cabinet, which includes those he beat in his leadership campaign. So can Keir Starmer heal the rifts that have long divided his party? Will he successfully lead this fresh team into first being an effective opposition and eventually into government? And is his leadership fated to be defined by the coronavirus? Without a pandemic end date in sight, many are predicting that society will be different when it's over, that a so-called new normal waits for us on the other side. But what will it look like? We'll hear from The Guardian's Europe correspondent, John Henley, on whether this might prove to be the virus that killed populism in Europe. Plus, new Shadow Justice Secretary David Lammy speaks to my colleague Rajiv Sayal about his new book and how its message applies to the changing world around us. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, you might be surprised to hear me presenting the podcast this week. As you can imagine, everyone on our Westminster team is up to their eyes keeping us up to date. So for a few weeks, I'll be here as Heather Stewart and Rowena Mason continue to report on these strange and unsettling times. The plan is to check in with them each week and talk about the most recent news out of Westminster. Listeners to last week's show will remember that The Guardian's political editor, Heather Stewart, had come down with symptoms of the virus. But happily, and luckily for us, she's back at work this week. I called her to see how she's doing.
Much better, thank you. I had about a week of what I assume is the dreaded virus. But my main symptom was just to feel completely exhausted all the time and be taking to my bed at lunchtime. But I think it's gone.
But no doubt in your mind that it was that.
Well, I had the flu jab this year, so it seems to be the only other thing it could have been was some other kind of flu, but it seems pretty unlikely. And I know that I have been in the same room as, you know, several other people who I know have had it, not least the Prime Minister. So it seems likely that it was the thing.
Well, you mentioned the Prime Minister, and obviously it's a very big week you've come back to. I mean, you and your colleagues in the lobby were asking lots of questions at the daily briefings on particularly this point about what happens now and who exactly now is in charge. And I think it was you who elicited this really fascinating revelation that Dominic Raab, as the nominated deputy, hadn't even spoken to the Prime Minister since Saturday. But who now is in charge, and what is the, as it were, chain of command?
Well, nominally it is Dominic Raab. So he has the title of First Secretary of State. That was a decision that Boris Johnson made when he appointed his cabinet. And that effectively means that Raab is the number two. So I imagine what Johnson was thinking at the time was Raab would stand in for him at Prime Minister's questions when he was on a foreign trip, that kind of thing. That's the normal role of someone with that title. But of course, in these circumstances, it means that he is the sort of nominal figurehead. So he's chairing those important morning committee briefings that sort of oversee the government's approach to tackling the virus. I mean, having said that, Downing Street have been quite careful to say, and Michael Gove was making this point yesterday, that collective cabinet responsibility still very much applies. So it's not as if Dominic Raab could sort of sit in the Foreign Office and you know, by diktat, make lots of decisions countermanding things that Boris Johnson thought were a good idea last week. It's not quite like that. It's a bit more collective. But it does sort of reveal the fact that, you know, we don't have a formal deputy prime minister in any sense. And it has felt a bit like Boris Johnson has not wanted to fully let go of the reins of power at any point. You know, in our constitution, the prime minister is always the prime minister. There isn't really a formal deputy. And last week he continued to work, didn't he? When, you know, one wonders with hindsight, perhaps he should have said, actually, someone else is going to chair these meetings for a week. Someone else is going to take over. I am going to rest.
And what you say is right. The probably, you know, Dominic Raab was envisaged as the kind of equivalent of David Lidington for Theresa May, yeah. You know, just doing the odd turn at Prime Minister's questions. But if this goes on a long time, and people are obviously urging the Prime Minister to recover and be well, but even, you know, in that situation, it is going to take some time for convalescence. Under our system, what happens if this isn't just a day or two, but is weeks or even months? I mean, do they just sit around the cabinet table and do things collectively indefinitely?
Yeah, I think it's very unclear, right? Unless the Conservative Party formally decided it wanted to replace Boris Johnson as leader of the Conservative Party, which obviously they're not going to do, there isn't really any formal process for deciding what happens other than, as you say, cabinet making the decisions. And I think that's why Mark Sedwill, the cabinet secretary, has sort of played a role in recent days. It was evidently him who sort of informed the cabinet about Boris Johnson's condition and what was happening and so on, because he has to be the sort of guardian of the constitution at this point, doesn't he? He has to sort of make sure that the wheels keep turning, even when, you know, the sort of usual focus of power is not there. I think it's a very sort of ambiguous situation.
And one of the big decisions that you feel only could be taken by the Prime Minister is this question of how exactly and when we would leave lockdown. And you at Tuesday's press briefing did ask that question about whether or not we were going to get the 3-week review on Monday, which Boris Johnson did promise when he first announced the lockdown. Tell us about the answer you got.
Well, it wasn't really an answer, was it? It was a sort of, you know, I sort of repeatedly asked whether this 3-week review, which Boris Johnson mentioned, as you say, when he did his sort of somber broadcast to the nation, he said, we'll review these measures after 3 weeks. And actually the law that passed, the act that passed that week, enshrining the sort of powers that the police have to enforce the lockdown and so on, that has to be reviewed within 3 weeks, which takes us to next Thursday. Raab's answer was really, we'll be guided by the data, and a bit that they want to wait until the peak. They feel the peak has passed. And I think the rationale behind that may partly be that Johnson doesn't want any big decisions taken in his absence, or there's a concern about taking big decisions in Johnson's absence. I think it's also because they have decided internally that if they start talking about unwinding the lockdown or you know, changing the situation, it will instantaneously have an effect on people's behaviour. I think they're worried that if they start to say, right, well, this goes on for another, whatever, 2, 3, 5 weeks, everybody will start sort of looking towards that and beyond that and might start creeping, you know, back out of their doors again. I think that's their worry.
If we're talking about the kind of leadership class in this country, we had another member of that group, senior member of that group, namely Michael Gove, this week announcing that he is also self-isolating because a member of his household had started to display symptoms of the virus. And it has been a bit of a phenomenon. I mean, Chris Whitty, who we've mentioned, Boris Johnson, obviously, Michael Gove, Matt Hancock, they all have all at one point or other been self-isolating. Why is it, do you think, that the leading group, the national leadership in this country, has been affected so badly, where you don't read equivalent reports from other ruling groups around the world?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know whether there was more. So it certainly felt, sitting in Parliament day after day while it was already going on, it certainly felt as though there was a real attempt to carry on. I mean, Johnson actually used the phrase himself, didn't he? Business as usual. You know, right up until it was impossible to do otherwise, they wanted to keep Parliament open. They wanted to keep operating. You know, Jacob Rees-Mogg was saying, I've had Public Health England in, and he's looked at the division lobbies and he thinks, you know, as long as we open the doors, open the windows, it'll be fine. You know, there was a real insistence on carrying on as normal. And I don't know whether maybe that hasn't helped. I mean, certainly there were ministers, weren't there, who caught it early. So Nadine Dorries, the mental health minister, she had it quite early. There were several others. Anne-Marie Trevelyan, the international development secretary, also caught it. So I don't know whether, you know, there was a slight delay in accepting the reality of it and an insistence. There's a, certainly around Johnson, I think, and his team, there's a kind of bullishness, you know, there's a kind of determination that, you know, we're tough. You could see it in the language Raab used yesterday, saying Johnson was a fighter and he was going to pull through. There was a sort of, you know, I think they felt part of their response to sort of, you know, G-ing up the country and getting us all through this was that they had to show they were just getting on with their jobs and they were going to carry on as usual. But actually, that was very, very risky by that point, it seemed.
Now, while the Prime Minister and his health has absolutely, obviously and rightly been the biggest story of the week, it wasn't the only big news. And over the last weekend, we had the emergence, after what had felt like a 50-year-long leadership contest, of a new Labour Party leader in the form of Keir Starmer, who has now nominated and chosen his shadow cabinet. What were your thoughts on it? Did any of the names, big or small, surprise you?
Yeah, some. So I thought it was a very comprehensive clear out, wasn't it, of the sort of Jeremy Corbyn era. So some key figures around Corbyn, Diane Abbott, John McDonnell and so on had said that they would stand down. But it was a really sort of sweeping changes across the shadow cabinet, really, which I thought was interesting. No particular need to feel like he needs to conciliate that wing of the party, apart from giving Rebecca Long-Bailey a post shadow education. I think Annalisa Dodds,
he had to do that,
he had to give her a senior post, but you know, aside from that, which, as you say, I think he had to do, there were very few left figures remaining around the table. I thought Annalisa Dodds was as interesting as shadow chancellor. She's not that well known. She's sort of fearsomely clever, and I think will be very sort of interesting counterpoint to Rishi Sunak. Lisa Nandy as shadow foreign secretary, I was slightly surprised by that. I had felt that Emily Thornberry actually performs pretty well in that role, was pretty good at holding Raab to account and has done well during this crisis in dealing with, for example, the repatriation of Brits stranded on their hulls abroad, which, you know, the government's been quite slow on. But whether that was a job, again, Nandy clearly earned herself a big frontline role in the leadership contest.
Yes, I was slightly expecting Lisa Nandy to have a role that would have allowed her to pursue her so-called towns agenda.
Yes, indeed.
You know, something like communities or local government, where she could have talked about reconnecting Labour with those parts of the country. I was quite surprised he didn't play to that sort of side of her strength.
Yes, I was indeed. Yeah, so I had not expected her to be shadow foreign secretary, but it'd be very, very interesting. You know, foreign policy is one of the issues she's very interested in. So it will be, yeah, quite interesting to see how that unfolds.
There was one theory that he did that because she is one of those people who knows how to manage to be simultaneously very pro-Palestinian without ever straying into somehow being anti-Jewish, which brings us to the other theme of the week a bit for him, which was that one of his very first tasks was to talk to leaders of the Jewish community, given how much anti-Semitism had been an issue in the Corbyn period. And those leaders were very quick to praise him for his efforts, issuing a joint statement afterwards that said Keir Starmer's already achieved more in 4 days than his predecessor did in 4 years in addressing anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. That's a pretty important seal of approval, isn't it?
It's really important, yes. And you know, it was a reminder, really. I mean, he got out there straight away, didn't he, on his very first day with this letter, and then followed it up, you know, within days with a face-to-face meeting, or what passes for a face-to-face meeting these days, a video conference, which evidently left people feeling quite reassured. I mean, his was one of the voices in the shadow cabinet repeatedly raising this. You know, he'd also talked about the fact that he had run a big organization when he was DPP. He knew that if you wanted to get on top of these things, you've got to lead from the top. You've got to be, you know, really upfront about it and put the right processes in place. And he seems to be really determined to do that. And it's very encouraging, I think.
And lastly, Heather, you and your colleagues, I know, are all willing the Prime Minister to return to health. I think everybody is. Are you able to simultaneously think and feel those things and also be asking all the tough questions and holding the government to account? Is it hard to do both at once?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it should be, because I think, you know, his being out of action raises quite a lot of important questions in itself. And you do have a bit of a sense of duty that you are trying to ask the questions, not wanting to be grand about it, but, you know, you're trying to ask the questions that people are sitting at home are wondering about. And I think you still feel that role being very important, even as you say, we're you know, hoping the Prime Minister gets better and out of hospital as soon as possible.
That was The Guardian's political editor, Heather Stewart. Now, in the last 5 years, populist parties have surged across Europe as continental economies faltered and debate raged over rising levels of immigration. Politicians offering nativist nationalism have gained traction. So how has the coronavirus affected the populists and their popularity? The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley has this report.
Alors maintenant, il y a deux solutions. Soit l'Union européenne comprend qu'il y a un énorme problème et arrête de foncer dans le mur, écoute les peuples et participe à la...
Il governo più europeista della storia del mondo, con Gentiloni in trincea a Bruxelles, dovrebbe ottenere tutto in un momento di emergenza.
So populism tends to define or pitch a sort of a pure and virtuous people against a corrupt and nefarious elite. That's the kind of the common denominator of populism, if you will. We should think of it as kind of a style of politics, really, rather than as an ideology in itself. So it can kind of like piggyback on far left-wing politics, far right-wing politics. You know, we've seen, for example, in the 30s and 40s in Europe, you had sort of the fascist dictatorships had very strong elements of populism in them. You've seen in Latin America, you've seen populist regimes. I'm thinking of the sort of far left populist regimes. Thinking of Venezuela, a far right one at the moment. We have in Bolsonaro in Brazil.
O que tínhamos que conter naquele momento era o pânico, a histeria e, ao mesmo tempo, traçar a estratégia.
More recently in Europe, we're used to these kind of nationalist right-wing populists, Le Pen in France and Salvini in Italy, the AfD in Germany. But always the common denominator is this idea that you're pitching a sort of a pure and virtuous people who are always right because they represent, you know, the voice of the common people against a supposedly corrupt and evil elite.
Seit der deutschen Einheit, nein, seit dem Zweiten Weltkrieg, gab es keine Herausforderung an unser Land.
So what we're seeing at the moment is actually a really interesting effect, and it's a surge in the approval ratings, in the popularity, essentially, of democratic leaders around the world. Some of these surges are really quite remarkable, some are more modest, but it's almost universal, and it's in parallel with the advance of the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades, and this country is not alone.
All over the from world, Boris Johnson, whose sort of, you know, satisfaction rating is up 5 points in the polls, and Donald Trump in the US, whose satisfaction approval rating is at its highest since he entered the White House, in fact. Those two are interesting because they've both obviously been heavily criticized for the way they've handled the pandemic so far. But also, you know, Giuseppe Conte in Italy, he sort of is not a politician. He was a law professor most of his career before he became Prime Minister of Italy in 2018. But his approval rating in the country which has suffered the most deaths in the world from the coronavirus is currently, you know, up at sort of stratospheric levels, about 72%. Emmanuel Macron in France as well, his satisfaction rating has surged by sort of 13 to 15 points. Angela Merkel in Germany, I mean, that's an extraordinary figure. Her popularity rating, approval rating at the moment is 79%, which is quite remarkable when you think, you know, this is a fourth term chancellor. She's already said she's going to be standing down before the next elections, and yet her rating is up at this extraordinary level. So there's clearly a kind of, you know, a very unusual effect going on here. There's a name for this effect, for this phenomenon, and it was first identified by an American political scientist called John Mueller back in 1970. He was looking at the approval ratings, the sort of satisfaction ratings of US presidents during the Cold War years. And he noticed that at times of particular crisis, their popularity tended to spike quite dramatically. And he coined this phrase, the rally round the flag effect. So he defined this rally round the flag effect, or what he said needed to be, was necessary for it to happen, was some kind of major international event, kind of a, you know, an event of global importance, which directly implicated the leader of the day. And he said that that event had to be both dramatic, it had to be very specific, and it had to be very focused. And if you look, quite recently, quite a few political scientists have pointed out that, you know, those definitions, those criteria, pretty much perfectly match the coronavirus pandemic. The populist opposition parties in Europe, the Salvinis and Le Pens and the AfD in Germany, have been kind of relatively quiet during the spread of the coronavirus crisis. You know, and I think that also fits in with what we know of this rally round the flag effect, which is that, you know, there is clearly this sort of feeling of broad support for the government that's in charge. The whole political debate becomes less partisan. When people are rallying around the flag, it's clearly counterproductive for opposition politicians to be attacking the government. And also people just, you know, genuinely are looking for a sense, they're looking for security, they're looking to be comforted, they're looking, you know, to the people who can help them out of this crisis when they're sort of worried and alarmed. These effects can last for a while, but they certainly don't last forever. And I think what most political scientists seem to be saying at the moment for the coronavirus crisis is that, you know, there will come a time of reckoning when the crisis finally subsides. And that will be when the opposition, and particularly the populist opposition, will come kind of roaring back. Obviously, this crisis, this coronavirus crisis at the moment is a massive health crisis. It's also increasingly a massive economic crisis, which is going to last much longer than the health crisis will last. So, you know, the world will be in this economic crisis. And we all know that out of economic crises are born social crises. There's going to be very high unemployment. A lot of companies will have gone bust. And that really is going to be very, very fertile ground for the populists in the sort of months and years to come. Quite how particularly Europe comes out of this crisis and how much, you know, the EU27 as a whole, what they can do to sort of collectively mitigate the worst impact, that'll make a real difference. For example, we're already starting to see in Italy, you know, very strong, and Spain, very strong and strident criticism of the EU. It'll be very fertile ground for the populists in the months to come.
The Guardian's John Henley. After the break, my colleague Rajiv Sayal talks to David Lammy about being picked to be in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet, the effect a new tribalism is having on British society, and whether or not we will recalibrate after this pandemic is over. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. One of Keir Starmer's most eye-catching picks for his shadow cabinet is the Labour MP for Tottenham, David Lammy. A few months before he got that all-important phone call, and before the coronavirus outbreak hit the UK, David Lammy published a book, Tribes: How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. In it, he tells of his own journey to find out more about his ancestry. He also looks at what he calls the new tribalism, an urgent need most of us have for a sense of belonging, and what some of us will do to get it. The Guardian's Whitehall correspondent Rajiv Sayal spoke to him about the book and how this tribalism might evolve after the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hi, David.
Hi.
First of all, congratulations are in order. Where were you when you got the call from Sir Keir, the new leader of the Labour Party?
I was sitting in my front lounge with my wife. I can't remember what we were discussing or looking through, probably something to do with the kids homeschooling. And I got that call and I was very happy, very happy.
Good stuff. And was there any form of Zoom celebration last night? Did you all get together somehow?
Well, we had celebrated on Zoom. This is the folk that had been engaged in Keir's campaign last week, Friday. So we had sort of had that moment as a group. It was just great to get the call from Keir. You know, it was just really nice for him to put his faith in me. So it was great. It was a really good moment.
I want to move on to your book, Tribes. Early on, you look at exactly what a tribe is. And that definition has changed through the centuries, right?
It has. You know, tribes was a word that was quite common when I was growing up. You know, in my teens, it was a word that was used a lot in school, in classes like geography. It fell out of fashion, and it fell out of fashion because it was very much a colonial phrase. Yeah. And it sometimes was used to describe non-white people. I don't want to resurrect it in that sense, but I am using it in my new book because I'm talking about the new tribalism. These are communities of people coming together, sometimes virtually through social media, people that are identifying strongly, often along political, partisan, and ethnic basis. Many of your listeners will recognize it, and that's what I wanted to talk about in the book. I got to this because I suddenly realized in the last few years that if I used my voice in the public forum to stand up on behalf of people like those who died in Grenfell Tower, like the Windrush generation, people would say things like, "Why do you hate the English? Go back to the jungle," and horrendous things, death threats included. And I thought, you know, but I am English, you know, as well as British. I care about this country. And so the book has got a memoir feel to it because I write about the various tribes, if you like, to which I belong to. But it's also a reflection on our times.
This new era of tribalism has led some people to look to new identity groups in which to find a belonging. And you say that the rational is increasingly being replaced by the emotional. Has the political world already fallen into these new tribalism era?
Well, a chapter I'm proud of in the book is on identity politics. It was hard to write because I'm one of those characters in British public life that people accuse of being, if you like, an identificarian, a driving identity politics. And what I explain in that chapter is, look, I lost a dear friend in Grenfell Tower and raised real issues on behalf of the sorts of people who were living in that tower and in that part of West London. When Windrush came up in our national life, I thought of my parents, my elder brothers, and the idea that they could be denied a claim on the country that they had committed to. And I fought very hard. And I'm informed by being a black ethnic minority in this country. Of course I am. But I also reflect in that chapter that we can't just be in the business of identity. We've got to find common ground. Or what you get is lots of competing identities in society. And we're sort of seeing that as there's a sort of language that separates the working class. You have to share the national story and the common ground. There has to be a broader identity that you can all be part of. And we as politicians of all political stripes have to work hard on that. In my own party, we've had a lot to say, of course we have, on economy, on inequality, on class and deprivation. We need to be talking also about common culture and the kind of culture we want to promote. This harks back, if you like, to great traditions like the National Health Service, which is for all of us and that we see with such virtue at this moment in time. Things like the BBC, again, which can establish a common purpose and a common language. And we need to work harder at that if we're not to move into more atomized, identitarian kind of places.
Just to turn to Party Matters, you've obviously seen quite an intense demand for loyalty and discipline within your own party, and that's fluctuated and changed quite dramatically since you obviously joined in the era of Tony Blair and you lived through the Corbyn era. How has that been for you?
Well, that's a really good question. I think I've probably got to write my memoirs to be completely truthful about it. Look, 20 years in politics. When I arrived in politics in 2000, it was the age of apathy. People like Fukuyama were writing books that it's the end of history. There was a consensus. Politics was fought in the centre. It was a different period. But of course, Labour, in order to get to power, had to be extremely disciplined in office. And that's what you saw under Tony Blair. I got a little bit disillusioned, I got to say, towards the end of the noughties, in that period that began under Gordon Brown. I was hugely excited by my friend Barack Obama in the States becoming the American leader, but Labour was floundering. And of course, that then led into the Ed Miliband period and Jeremy Corbyn. And I was on the back benches in that period and campaigning, taking up the issues that I care about, speaking truth to power. And in a sense, I suppose I've garnered a lot of popularity in that period, but I've definitely been at the centre of national life. I've just been vice chair of Keir Starmer's campaign. I'm delighted that he's become leader of the Labour Party. I think that credibility is going to be very important for us and he can deliver that. Unity is essential. We've been a very, very divided party. And if you're divided in public in the ways that we've been, of course the British people aren't going to turn to you. So I think we've got a grown-up in charge. I think there's a lot of credibility. I think this is a moment where we come together. It's an exciting moment. It's great to see joy in the Labour Party and left and right working together to support Keir Starmer.
Right. Is there going to be a problem hugging close the left of the party that identified very closely with Jeremy Corbyn, given that they appear and the people that he promoted appear to now have been demoted?
Well, you know, Rebecca Long-Bailey is our shadow education secretary. All political parties are broad coalitions. In our country, we've got largely, you know, a two-party system. I know we've got some smaller parties, but largely it's Labour and the Conservatives. These are big, big coalitions of interests. And there are differences within that coalition. But what you've got to do is be able to, one, have your disagreements privately, present a united front to the public, and you've got to change with the times. So I'm certainly of the view that here as we talk in 2020, we've got to be forward-looking, recognise that we're a coalition, be respectful and kind to one another, and ultimately listen and hear the British people as we move forward. And clearly, you know, we've had a little bit too much talking to ourselves and not sufficiently to the public. So I hope we can keep all of the traditions of the party together as we navigate this move forward. But, you know, I don't want to be too party obsessed and too tribally obsessed. In a way, that's for the birds. What matters is power. And because I represent a lot of people who are powerless, and in order to have power, you have to be, yes, tenacious, but also persuasive. And to do that, you have to listen to the British public and you get beyond your tribe because you are persuading people beyond your tribe to vote for you. And that's the business we've got to be in. And I think Keir can get us there.
As we've seen the various revolutions in the past century or so, the Industrial Revolution or the Technological Revolution, we've seen the rise of individualism and people bettering themselves or their loved ones and thinking of the community they live in as an afterthought. But you suggest a rejection of this form of individualism has taken place recently, that it's gone too far. What examples do you have of this?
Well, look, we're definitely living in a super individualized world in which we can be very conscious of our rights, but not of our responsibilities. And, you know, COVID-19 and the way we've had to react to this pandemic is illustrative of this. this. On the one hand, it reminds us of our common humanity. On the one hand, you save lives if you stay at home. On the one hand, you can help your elderly neighbor. And we're seeing extraordinary examples of that. And it's wonderful to see once again doctors and nurses, public servants, as the heroes of our time and not some of the sort of celebrity characters that we've lauded in the past. But on the other hand, selfishness, hoarding things like toilet paper, scrapping in supermarkets, flouting the rules and putting other people in danger. This has also been a theme of what we're seeing. And so it's strange. I was writing this, of course, before the pandemic, but it's illustrative, if you like, of the tensions in society between, on the one hand, a kind of collectivist ideal, coming together, supporting each other, the common purpose, the common ground, and what I talk about in the book, a civic nationalism that makes me very, very, very proud. But on the other hand, conscious that some would exclude someone like me, that we've got a new ethnic nationalism in resurgence in a country like ours. We see it also in the United States. And the dangers of that is a divided country. And of course, I'm also writing at a time when, after we've dealt with this pandemic, it's very likely we're going to have a recession. And the scary thing about the recession that might be to come, having gone through it last time after 2008, is that you see a rise in extremism. And so it's about how we come together, how we create that encounter culture, and how governments take this very deadly seriously, or we end up with a very atomized society.
In the book, you recount a moment in 2016 when Theresa May said that, and I quote, "If you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what citizen means." If there was ever a moment in world history where she was maybe proven wrong, it's now, isn't it?
Turned flat on its head. You know, what we're seeing at this moment is a lack of global leadership. After this selfish period in which our country was totally internally divided over the issue of Brexit, and which we were looking not outward but totally inward, a period where Donald Trump has literally removed the United States from the global scene, it would appear the only grown-up in the room was Angela Merkel left. And this failure of leadership in the G7 and the G20 to really grip this, work together, because you've got to work together, to share science, share intelligence, to assist in resources where other countries, particularly poorer ones, would struggle. That's the only way you defeat this virus. And I think once we're over this and through this, we will look back at a failure of the global community to act together. So there are downsides to globalization. But if you're looking at the refugee crisis, if you're looking at climate change, as I talk in the book, you can only deal with those issues as coming together. But I guess in the end, if we're living in societies where people don't feel a powerful sense of belonging, if we're living in communities in which the local has been largely decimated, in which there seems to be little respect for people, say, whether they're in Middle America or Middle England or Northern England, and power is hoarded at the centre in London, it's not surprising then that people find it very hard to support global initiative because they're very ill at ease individually and indeed in terms of their neighbourhood and their localities. So we've got a lot to fix. In the end, we defeat this, get over this with global solutions.
You talked in depth about your trip to Niger after doing a DNA test that connected you with the Tuareg tribe. Excuse my pronunciation. At one point you wrote, "Belonging is also a source of comfort, solidarity and shared experience," end quote. Now, I'm making a leap from your personal history to a worldview, but will there be a sense of tribalism in all of us who make it through this incredibly tough time?
Well, you know, for me, the odyssey and the trip that I talk about in the book to Niger, to having done a DNA test to find my tribal ancestors in the Tuareg tribe, was extremely special moment. But what I found there was, in fact, that yes, it was great, but I'm not really a Tuareg. I'm English, and I'm proud to be Caribbean. I'm proud to be a Spurs supporter. And as I sit here speaking to you in London, I want my fellow Englishmen to get through this. You know, Boris Johnson is in ICU at St. Thomas Hospital, and I wish him, his family, the very, very best. So I think that after this, we can come together around our common humanity, recognize that, you know, as tough as we've had it here in the United Kingdom, I suspect by the end of this story in developing countries, it would have been considerably worse and many, many more people would have lost their lives. Reach out to help despite the challenges that exist for us.
Now, after talking about the pride you took from belonging to the Tuareg tribe, your next section is called How Belonging Can Break Society. And I suppose we only have to look to the Windrush scandal as an example of this. Now, an independent inquiry into the government's handling of the scandal was published back in March, which may be because of the coronavirus outbreak, didn't seem to break the news cycle for long. But just how much damage did this moment in UK politics do in casting doubt over people's identities?
Well, I mean, clearly the Windrush scandal leaves an indelible mark on British history and is a very low moment. It's a low moment because after the Second World War, our country needed rebuilding. We weren't lacking in imagination in the sense that we built the NHS, and the Black citizens that came from the Commonwealth, who were asked to come, came and contributed hugely to the rebuilding of modern Britain and the Britain that we all enjoy. And therefore, to strip them of their rights, deny them the right to housing, the right to pensions, to detain them, arrest them unfairly, and to deport some of them, I think was a horrendous, horrendous moment. The conclusions of the review by Wendy Williams is worth reading. It's a very comprehensive and very good piece of work. It challenges the Home Office really to understand our shared history and colonial history, to look harder at itself in terms of discrimination and the way that, of course, we have to protect our borders. But it's a challenge to move away from a hostile environment to an environment that is hospitable. And that, I think, is another aspect of the British character, hospitality.
The pandemic has brought to the fore the need for migrants in this country. And at the time of your book's publication, around 139,000 of the 1.2 million people who work for the NHS are foreign nationals. Four of the first NHS workers to die from this virus were from ethnic minorities. Are you hopeful that British society will recalibrate when this is all over and that your neighbours in Peterborough, who wrote about who voted for Brexit mainly because of their worries over immigration, will rethink the way that they see immigration in the future?
Well, look, I am hopeful. The face of the National Health Service is very much a diverse face. I mean, diverse in all senses, people from all backgrounds, all cultures, all classes. That is the face of the National Health Service. And that those that have immediately lost their lives who've been frontline workers are Muslim doctors, nurses from varied backgrounds is an indication of that diversity. And they're sacrificing their life, putting themselves on the line to protect lives. This is a moment to hold up with good grace those that are doing that. And I hope that what comes out of it is a renewal and a sense of the importance of that. And some of the rhetoric we've heard in the past, a hostile environment, I hope that recedes to the margins where it belongs.
My last question, you discuss identity politics throughout the book, and at one point you write, identity politics becomes a problem when it is the only politics. We've seen throughout this episode, and particularly this week, that COVID-19 transcends politics. And you're now part of a new Labour cabinet, which will work alongside Tories, Lib Dems, SNP MPs, and many more to mitigate the suffering for Britons. Is this the end to such stringent identity politics, or is it simply on hold?
Because of the work of people like Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Emily Pankhurst, Harvey Milk. The story of the 20th century is that men and women who could never have self-actualized, never have dreamed the dreams to participate fully in society, were able to do that. Women, gay men and women, black and ethnic minorities. That's a great, great story. But sadly, here as we sit in 2020, amongst some major, major individuals in the world and countries, that is still contested. And I'm afraid there are traditions, particularly on the right of politics, and there are elements on the left. It's important to assert identity and rights on behalf of minority communities. But at the same time, as I sit here as someone who's had to defend so much in this last 5 years, really quite staggered that I've had to do that, because that wasn't the case when I first became an MP 20 years ago. It wasn't necessary to have these battles. I mean, this is not a moment for me to be overly preoccupied with race and ethnicity. This is a moment of national effort and where we come together as human beings, which in the end is the first and foremost condition of our times, to hold out a hand of friendship and opportunity to work with others. And it's why, you know, working with the opposition is so important. And the first call I made, of course, was to the Secretary of State for Justice, because actually working with the Secretary of State for Justice as we deal with prisoners and indeed the problems that we're facing in the courts as a result of COVID are what is central and ultimately important at this time.
David Lammy talking to Rajiv Sial. And there's a link to where you can buy David Lammy's book on this week's episode description on the Guardian website. But that is all from us this week. For anyone wanting to hear less about the politics and more about the science behind coronavirus, The Guardian's Science Weekly team are producing special weekly episodes of their podcast where you can hear from experts working on the front line as they explore listeners' most pressing questions. And before we sign off, just to say a huge thank you to all of you who have supported The Guardian to date. As you know, in times of global crisis, like the one we're living through now, trusted news is more important than ever. The Guardian is committed to accurate, reliable news in all our reporting, and you can help us to provide the quality information the world needs by supporting us. Just head to theguardian.com/support podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Heather Stewart, John Henley, Rajiv Sial, and David Lammy. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.